Item 816, amend relocation assistance regulations in affordable housing preservation and Portland renter protections.
Colleagues, first I'd like to present an amendment to swap out what was filed in the 710 amendments. That, as you will recall, was a minor fix. It switches that out for a who. Is there any further discussion on that? And can I get a second?
Second, absolutely.
So we have a motion and a second. Please call the roll on the amendment.
Salzman.
Aye.
Udaly.
Aye.
Fritz.
I'm actually delighted with this. I thought it should have been who. Aye.
Fish. Wheeler. Excuse me.
Let the record show that there is no matter too small for my attention. Aye. The amendment is adopted. Colleagues, I'm happy to bring forward these technical fixes to you today. As I've said many times before, we're in a housing emergency, and we need to continue to do everything we possibly can to improve the experience of renters and families who are experiencing housing stability in our community. Despite our strongest efforts at lobbying and coalition work, unfortunately, the legislature was not able to provide our city or the state with a just cause eviction standard or rent control tools that we believe would have significantly helped us to address this emergency right now. Therefore, it's up to us to continue to take bold action to address this housing crisis using the tools that we currently have at our disposal, like mandatory relocation assistance. In February of this year, the council mandated that landlords in the city of Portland pay relocation assistance to tenants experiencing rent increases of 10% or more and tenants being evicted for no cause. There was an abundance of public testimony from housing justice advocates, community groups, and landlords and tenants alike, and it became clear that the community at large had a handful of outstanding questions about the mandatory relocation assistance legislation. So in response, we passed mandatory relocation assistance with an amendment that mandated that the Housing Bureau assemble an advisory group of landlords, tenants, and other interested parties to identify technical issues within the legislation and propose solutions to the issues that were identified. As I'm sure you all remember, the Technical Advisory Committee met several times throughout March and April, and they compiled their proposed amendments for the Bureau's consideration. At the end of May, the Housing Bureau staff presented changes to the Mandatory Relocation Assistance Ordinance on behalf of the Technical Advisory Committee. The Council did not come to a consensus on the presented changes and asked that the Technical Advisory Committee revisit the recommendations with some clarifications. Housing Bureau staff facilitated additional meetings of the Technical Advisory Committee, and they've returned with additional recommendations today. I'm going to turn it over to Director Krieger, who actually, he's not here today. Is that correct?
I'm not sure.
He may not be here today, but certainly Matthew Schaebold is here from the Housing Bureau. And so in just a few minutes, we're going to go over the details of the recommendations. But first, I wanted to share just a couple more things. First, affordable, accessible, and quality housing for all Portlanders is one of my top priorities. And I know it is a top priority of this city council. And I believe that tools like mandatory relocation assistance give us a real shot at providing basic needs. That's why I'm directing the Housing Bureau to continue to have the Mandatory Relocation Technical Assistance Advisory Group meet to determine what a potential long-term policy could look like. As you all know, this current policy is set to expire on October 6th. And two, affordable, accessible, and quality housing for all Portlanders is not one of my top priorities or this council's top priorities. We've heard loudly and clearly that it's also a top priority for Portlanders. I take meaningful and equitable community engagement very seriously, and I know that this policy must include the voices of some of those who are the most directly impacted. That's why I'm directing the Housing Bureau to open two new recruitments. The Portland Housing Advisory Commission, the Bureau's community advisory body, and also the Renter-Owner Services Advisory Commission, otherwise known as ROSEC. I'm drafting legislation to get this up and running, and this new advisory commission will advise on issues of rental housing law and regulations, landlord-tenant programs and services, and provide a forum for public input on rental housing. So with that, I will now turn this over to Matthew from the Housing Bureau and others on the technical advisory group. For example, Margot Black has been involved in this process, and she has been asked to testify as well. So with that, I will turn this over to you.
Thank you, Mayor, members of council. So I will quickly walk through the recommendations, and then we'll turn it over to some of our technical group members who wanted to provide some testimony. We have three folks here. So as the mayor mentioned, I guess first I'll just stop for a moment on this slide because I know some of our discussion today will be about the group, the technical advisor group, and reaching a consensus close to unanimous consensus. And so I just wanted to flag the organizations that were represented on the technical advisory group. As the mayor had mentioned, on the 25th, council directed the Housing Bureau specifically to revisit subsection C and subsection D and the proposed changes there within from the first set of amendments that were brought forward by the Housing Bureau to council, to share the feedback from council with the technical advisory group, and then see if the technical advisory group could come to a set of consensus recommendations to bring back to council based on city council's feedback. With that, the first clarification was that the request for relocation assistance is not the notice to terminate the rental agreement, which did require some changes to code. There was some confusion and candidly differing opinions from different attorneys about whether or not the code as written meant that a request for relocation assistance was in fact a notice to terminate. And so the request to clarify this on behalf of the technical advisory group was something that was shared by both renter representatives as well as landlord representatives. And actually, if I could, let me take just a quick step back. As I'm walking through these, I just want to emphasize that these are a package of amendments and that the consensus that was reached by the group was consensus on the overall package. So any significant changes or removals or additions, I couldn't necessarily say there would still be consensus for that package without going back to the group. So the second item is a change to the time frame, and there would be two changes. One would be to allow 45 days for the renter to request relocation assistance, and then 31 days to allow the landlord to pay that relocation assistance. Subsequent to the payment of the relocation assistance, the renter would have 6 months from the effective date of the rent increase. So not of the notice of the rent increase, but actually the effective date of the rent increase to do essentially one of two things. One would be to repay the relocation assistance, and the second would be to provide the landlord with a notice to terminate the rental agreement. And the conversation around this was that generally folks seem to acknowledge that 90 days was a pretty tight time frame for someone to try and assess whether or not they could what housing was available to them to move into once they got the relocation assistance. So some of the renter representatives in the discussion wanted to provide more time for renters to try and identify and secure new housing that was affordable to them. And the landlord representatives wanted more certainty in terms of, well, what is the end date at which we'll know that either we're getting the relocation assistance back because the renter will be staying, or that they are providing us a notice to terminate, and so they're moving out, and we can plan for the next renter to come in. And so this language was that compromise to reach that point. Given the longer time frame, there was some concern from representatives from the landlord side of the discussion that a renter could experience perhaps two qualifying events for relocation assistance because in theory they could still be in the rental unit for a year or longer after the initial rent increase. And so there was some clarification to make sure that in code it said that a renter could only receive and retain relocation assistance once per tenancy. and actually the code amendments you swapped out were due to some concerns that Commissioner Fritz had brought up on Friday when we had checked in with her about language in the code to make sure it was clear that it wasn't just receiving it once, but receiving and retaining in the event that perhaps they paid it back and stayed, but 2 years later, in the event of a permanent policy, there was a subsequent qualifying event. And then finally, to Commissioner Fritz's concern from the last city council hearing on the 25th, we worked with the city attorney's office to draft some language around the utilization of LLCs, and that should an individual who owns multiple rental units across the city have them each within their own LLC, and that LLC only owns one rental unit, that doesn't create an exemption from the relocation assistance. That was a concern that had come up, and so we incorporated that in with the code changes as well. I want to note one thing about the meeting in which we were able to come to this consensus on the package deal. Affinity Property Management was present. They participated in the discussion. They raised concerns, and they helped work through some of the trade-offs, but in the end, they chose simply to not take a position. I want to honor that on the record. PMAR, the Portland Metropolitan Association of Realtors, was not able to be present. Neither of their representatives were available on that date, but they did express in some email exchanges with staff before the meeting that they were not comfortable with a six-month time frame for their members. And then Meyer Memorial Trust representative did not take a position due to their legal and tax-exempt status. Well, so they participated from a kind of a technical expertise standpoint. They weren't forwarding any policy recommendations to a legislative body. So with that, I'm happy to take any questions.
Colleagues, any questions? Very good. Is there any public testimony on this item? I'm sorry. We have invited testimony.
We do. So we've got Margo and then Jessica and Katrina from the technical group.
Very good. I apologize, Margo.
Sorry if I snuck up too early. I thought I'd heard my
name. Nope, you're good. You're good. Thank you.
I'll wait for them to come up, if that's okay.
Thank you.
Morning, Commissioners. My name is Margo Black. As required by City Code, I will disclose that I am speaking on behalf of the lobby entity, Portland Tenants United. I'm also a member of the Relocation Technical Advisory Committee, and I want to give testimony today regarding my concerns for a couple of the proposed technical amendments to the relocation ordinance. As mentioned, the committee's met several times, each for a period of 3 hours, and through that process, we arrived at consensus on most of the amendments that you'll consider today, particularly the important package of amendments that Matthew just described. However, there's one technical clarification in today's proposed amendments that was not discussed by the committee, and this regards the exemption for landlords with a single rental unit. As defined by Oregon Revised Statutes Chapter 90.123, landlord includes their authorized representatives, so property managers. Practically speaking, this means that a landlord with only one unit who employs a property manager would not currently be exempt under the ordinance. Today's amendment seeks to clarify that such landlords should, in fact, be exempt, whether or not they use property managers or not. There's also proposed language that seeks to rightly clarify that landlords who have, say, five properties under five LLCs should not be exempt, though if one were to determine that their LLC landlord only had a financial interest in one unit, they would still be exempt. If this sounds complicated, it's because it is. Commissioners, ultimately, I'd like you to strongly consider limiting the exemption to only humans, not LLCs, and only those humans who personally manage their properties rather than those who use a property management company. And I ask you to consider this in light of my belief that this was, in fact, the original intent of the exemption. Absent of this limitation to humans only and only those who personally manage their properties, these types of tenants would be denied relocation assistance from the following owners. Owners who bought their single-family rental property online from a company like Roofstock, by putting their single-family rental property in their online shopping cart, all from the comfort of their out-of-state living room. These are not, obviously, your small, financially constrained mom-and-pop landlords, considering that Roofstock boasts owning rental property doesn't mean that you have to be a hands-on landlord. For buyers who want to be less involved while earning passive income, choosing the best rental property management company makes it easy to focus more on the investing aspect and less on day-to-day operational tasks. So these will be your single unit owning landlords in the city of Portland who will be exempt from paying relocation assistance when that property management company no-causes that tenant or increases the rent by more than 10%. And that's the crux of this. If this amendment is intended to exempt single unit owners because of the small financial burden on small landlords, the property management companies are literally incentivized to increase rent and to a certain extent, no cause evict because of finder's fees for replacing tenants, and they are responsible for making those decisions. So I don't believe it was the intention of council to exempt landlords who can afford to use such property management companies and whose decisions then cause the exact circumstances that we want to protect tenants from. It also denies tenants relocation when their landlord is an LLC and the burden of the is on the tenant to research who has a financial interest in that LLC. I very much appreciate the direction from the council to do as much as we can to limit that LLC loophole, but it still requires a tenant to go to the Secretary of State website and try to trace who has what financial interest. And it's really not easy. I consider myself highly technically literate, and I have run into many dead ends trying to figure out who has financial interests in what LLCs. So this really becomes an equity issue when tenants don't get this protection without having the knowledge, time, literacy, and resources to track down who owns their property. And this is fixed by requiring that the only landlords who are exempt are those who personally own and manage their properties. Council, though you know that as an advocate for tenants, I do not love that any tenants are exempt from relocation assistance when they're displaced from their homes through no fault of their own. But for the sake of diplomacy, I can accept it for the time being. However, I ask you to deeply consider what your intentions were when you did exempt single unit owning landlords and whether or not that exemption should extend to those who can afford to employ property managers, managers who are entirely responsible for the decision-making process that leads to rent increases and no-cause evictions, or have the business acumen to funnel their ownership issues or their ownership interests through an LLC. I provided council with proposed language that would limit this exemption to humans only and only those who personally manage their properties, as I believe this aligns with the original intent of the exemption and does not inadvertently make a loophole that is already being abused bigger. I'm grateful for your ongoing support of this policy and feel that the Relocation Technical Advisory Committee has been effective and professional. I'm fully in support of all the amendments that were discussed by the committee, but want to reiterate that this particular issue was not discussed, and that is because it was assumed that council's intent was to exempt certain landlords regardless of who manages their property. If that was your intent, then I will concede this point. But I would ask for your clarity on this. If it was not, I would like you to consider the revised amendment that I submitted to council by email this morning, and I have in front of me if you have any questions.
So, yes, that was my intent in proposing that amendment, which did pass by the council. And I appreciated you sending your testimony in early, and that you said that by and large you would prefer property managers, that they often are more professional than out-of-state owners who just leave things alone. I would submit to you that if I was an out-of-state owner, what I would do is on 90 days plus one, fire the property manager and then give the notice, and then the tenant's really stuck with trying to deal with some out-of-state owner rather than I don't think that that really solves the problem. So perhaps it could be something that the ongoing committee could discuss for when you come back with an ongoing package.
Well, as the lone person who voted against that amendment, I voted against it because no one could tell us how many units that would exempt and therefore how many tenants would be left without this vital protection. That's not because I don't think there should never be any exemptions. I do think an exemption, for instance, landlords who live on the same property as their tenants, like in a duplex or an ADU, could be a reasonable exemption. And those were the people we were mostly hearing from, someone that built an ADU in their backyard, anticipating an elderly parent moving in at some point, someone who lives side by side with a tenant in a duplex. That's almost like having a roommate and
personally owned and managed.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm very open to this amendment. My concern was that it wasn't discussed in the group, and that these amendments today have all been agreed upon by this body, and that we didn't have time to kind of talk about it between offices. So I'm open, and it's certainly something I think we should be discussing in October.
So I'll chime in on this in the same vein. I appreciate your bringing this to our attention. I think it is an important issue that does deserve further discussion. I think I'm of a mind of Commissioner Fritz. I would like to see this discussed in the committee that's obviously going to be looking at a longer-term solution now, and this should definitely be in the mix as part of those conversations. So I do appreciate your bringing it to our attention. Very good. Okay. Good morning.
Good morning, everyone. Thanks so much for having us here. My name is Katrina Holland, for the record, Executive Director of Community Alliance of Tenants. And I just had a few comments to highlight about the requirement for tenants to return the relocation assistance if they decide to swallow the rent increase and then having to give it back if they haven't been able to find a place. I'm sure it's no secret that this ordinance is one of the only almost ready-to-go tools we have available for us to address this housing crisis in Portland. And as an organization that's been representing most impacted renters for 21 years, we're ecstatic to know that this is a long-term policy in consideration by the council. We look forward to shepherding policies like this in other jurisdictions around the state and look forward to participating in conversations about what a long-term strategy would look like. A couple of items to highlight. We still believe that families need more than 6 months in order to find and secure a place. Ideally, we would love to see a year, but we agreed to support 6 months in the vein of being reasonable. However, we do feel like it does put most impacted renters up on the chopping block when it comes to being able to find a place to live and then potentially the added burden of having to give that money back. I also want to highlight that we also have a significant issue concerning notification from landlords to tenants. This was something that was brought up in the committee in the last meeting. I can't remember what date it was. It was early July. But in a nutshell, many tenants would be required to hand over this money if they have not found a place in 6 months. And according to the ordinance, there is no mandate for the landlord to let the tenant know that that is the case. So for people who have heard about the relocation ordinance from their friends or family, or maybe have not had an opportunity to be educated through an institution like City Council or like Community Alliance of Tenants, they would be obligated to pay this back if they haven't found a place and they don't know that that's the case, subjecting them to significant harm. And so we'd love to see some action taken by the council to make sure that there is a notification, even if it's not at the time of the notice being given. Perhaps it's just included with the check as a separate notice so that tenants will have an idea that that is happening. As an organization dedicated to providing support and empowering most impacted renters, specifically seniors, people with disabilities, black and brown families, immigrants and refugees, single-parent households, these two issues could pose significant challenges for them. It's no secret that the socioeconomic status of many of those families are significantly lesser than their white counterparts and middle-class counterparts. So I would strongly encourage the council to consider these amendments and pass them today. And we want to make sure that this policy minimizes harm, and this would create more harm for these families.
So you're interested in having the landlord notify the tenant at the time, or at some point, either the notice of the increase or the issuing of the check, that there is a six-month duration.
Right.
Okay.
Yep.
I think that's reasonable, and I would move that amendment.
Well, it seems like that could just be an administrative rule or a standard practice, that they're given a frequently asked questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, like I said, I don't have the exact wording in front of me, but I think it makes sense to say that a landlord will provide notice at either the notice of the rent increase or the issuance of the relocation check that it has a six-month duration attached to it. So yeah. I would move that amendment.
Because many families, it may take them 8 months to a year to find a place. And so without knowing that they are obligated to pay this back within 6 months, they'll end up swallowing the rent increase, thus taking away their money, and then having to pay it back. It would cause significant harm.
So I share your concerns about notice and clarity. I was surprised at the solution that the committee came back with. I think it's great to have the extended period to move out, and it serves the interests of landlords and tenants, which is ideal situation.
Agreed.
I'm concerned that a lot of landlords and tenants don't even know about our relocation policy and think that that language needs to be incorporated into the standard notice forms.
Agreed.
As far as the time period, it is my understanding, so a tenant gets 90 days notice of a no-cause eviction or rent increase.
Correct.
They have 45 days to say whether or not they're going to accept, well, on the rent increase, if they're going to accept it or they're going to move out.
Right.
Doesn't that 6 months begin at the end of that 90-day period?
It would, yes.
And then at the very end, they can give their notice. So it gets them to 10 months, mm-hmm. effectively.
Effectively. Potentially more if the notice is longer than 30 days.
Yeah, I'm just trying to track it through memory. So, yeah, and it's difficult because we don't have an office yet to kind of manage these new rules
right.
to make sure that everyone's aware. But, yeah, I definitely share those concerns. It seems like the notice coming with a check would make the most sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
If there's
Might
a notice
both.
That just, or both, yeah. I mean,
I'm just looking
no
at the code here. And
yeah.
it says termination notice in quotation marks, so presumably staff can have a template which would have the rules and the options as far as paying it back, staying, etc.
And the actual date that they have to give notice or they have to return those funds.
Right. It would just encourage families to be more prudent with the money they're looking for places to live, whether to give deposit to holds or for application fees, etc.
So perhaps when staff come back up, we can find out whether that can be done administratively or whether we need to amend the code again.
Okay.
Thank you.
Very good. Let me do this just to keep this tidy. If it's administrative, I'd prefer to keep the administrative option open. But Commissioner Saltzman has made a motion. Can we get a second?
Yeah, I'd prefer it be in the ordinance itself as a new subsection F.
Okay.
But you know where?
I mean, I would just put it at the end of the additional protections, add a new subsection F that says the landlord shall provide notice at the time of the 10% rent increase and at the time of the issuance of the relocation check that the duration of that is for 6 months.
I'll second that for discussion, Commissioner. I think actually it would go better as a new D and move everything else further down.
So
D.
why don't we have a motion in a second? Why don't we keep that open? And I would certainly welcome public testimony on this item and further staff input. Thanks, Katrina.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning. Hi, my name is Jessica Greenlee with Affinity Property Management. I'm their operations manager and part of the technical advisory committee. In listening to the discussion, I just am wondering if we can more thoroughly vet that language that you would want to add for notification, just because it is important that it's accurate and will comply legally, and we won't, especially if we have to incorporate that into paperwork and disseminate that out to staff, that does take time. And so if that is a requirement that we're going to put in there, if there's an opportunity to allow that not to happen under an emergency status, that would be very beneficial, I think, for being able to roll that out into notices. Just a thought to consider as you're looking at that. I would also like to bring to Council's attention another item that was not discussed in committee that is causing some just legal challenges. It has to do with the language in Section B at the very end of the paragraph. It says, for the purposes of this subsection, a landlord that declines to renew or replace an expiring rental agreement on substantially the same terms, except for the amount of the rent or associated housing costs, terminates the rental agreement and is subject to the provisions of this subsection. That is included in the no-cause section, and what we are experiencing is situations where a tenant will or a legal will obtain legal counsel if we change possibly a smoking policy on a property or an employee's employment has ended and they've lost their employee discount are two examples that we're working through now. However, because it's part of the no-cause section, we automatically incur damages in this situation because there's no obligation for the tenant to notify us of the substantially same terms. So not only are we then paying the relocation assistance payment, but we're also subject to Section D, where we're also paying damages on top of the relo without ever knowing we violated it, because substantially the same terms is not defined. So I would like for the council to consider possibly moving that section to Section C, where there is a notification requirement in place, so that if a violation does occur in there, or an attorney brings that to our attention, they consider that to be substantially the same terms, that we have the opportunity to work through that, because we have notification before we incur damages. I realize that this may be an item that is better addressed in the long-term policy than the short-term policy, but it is certainly something that we're starting to encounter more frequently.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. And again, I want to thank all three of you for your service on this committee. It was very, very helpful to get all these perspectives. I'll just state my preference. My preference is that we not make technical amendments on the fly here today. That's my preference. My preference would be that it is already mid-July, and we know that this ordinance expires on October 6th. And so I'd prefer that we have these technical discussions at the committee level and continue to weigh them and vet them and the consequences of making technical changes, and then bring that back as part of the longer-term package. But I do appreciate your bringing it forward.
Jessica, would it make sense to iterate what would constitute a substantial change? Because a change in a smoking policy...
I think that would be very beneficial. I think there's a couple of ways to address this. Rather it be defining what substantially the same terms are, or moving that into the subsection where it does require some kind of notification.
Okay.
But that would be very beneficial.
Very good.
Thank you.
Any further questions for this panel? Very good. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Is there any public testimony on this item?
We've had three people sign up.
Okay, very good.
Please come up when I call your name. Shedrick Wilkins, Anthony Bensavigo, if I have that pronounced correctly, and Alan Kessler.
Very good. And is there anybody else here who would like to testify on this issue? Very good. We'll close the list.
I'm Shedrick Wilkins, and I was about landlords. I was a brief tenant at Dignity Village, in which the rent there was $20 a month. It was very communal. I didn't last there, and then I'm a veteran. Now I'm under HUD, and I'm on food stamps. But I do think that I think the economy of the future will get worse, and we will have more homeless people. And I do believe in kind of a what is called a shack house existence that they're building. Some of these little shacks have solar panels on it. And in the last 5 years, I could have spent $5,000 on solar panels on my Dignity Village shack instead of paying the $100 I do a month to the HUD. And I would have liked it there. I liked it out there. It was kind of nice. Dignity Village has one bus, so I can commute to a job. I want to go back out to Dignity Village because I think people are going to wander out into the corridors again, unless, of course, they stay in these shack leased things in somebody's backyard, kind of. I know for a fact, too, that a lot of people on the East Coast, when wintertime comes, they call up their relatives. They sell their blood, take a bus out here, spend 6 months during the wintertime, and go back to their relatives, their other relatives in New York someplace. So, and Portland has very moderate climate, low population, and a lot of churches that'll give you some canned food. But I'm going to do one experiment. Every year I have to solicit for food stamps. And I have to call a state office. So what I've done is I'm going to take some little solar panels and prop them in my window and power up my cell phone. And you cannot email anybody for food stamps. You have to give verbal testimony in February that I stay here and call somebody. I usually do it from the Hollywood. I will get a phone, and I will see if I can conduct and get a lot of information from just a couple solar panels propped in the window. And if I certainly went back to Dignity Village, I could use those. And my son says I can put a keyboard in my phone and get a low-cost ISP and get on the internet. So I'm going to do some of these little experiments. And it's one advantage, you know, in the 1920s when people were homeless, we do have a lot of this, what I call crystal magic, people's ability to get electricity from the sun, telecommute. I know some people actually write programs that have made $50,000 on an Apple phone. So it's amazing how you can do that. Be another Zuckerberg or something like that. And you don't have to have an office. You can just do it with a phone.
Thank you.
Commissioners, Mayor, Alan Kessler. I'm an attorney. I don't practice landlord-tenant law normally, but since this relocation ordinance, I've been accepting pro bono clients, tenants who are facing a no-cause eviction. So I've had several clients who are sort of trying to deal with the nuances of this law, and it's a challenge. I would submit to you that I believe it should be the policy of the council that no-cause evictions should be rare, should not be a normal tool, but should be in unusual circumstances. And to the extent that somebody's in the business of managing property, they can predict about the rate at which they're going to have to no-cause evict people, and they can build that into their fees and into the rent. They can amortize it over the whole population of tenants so that they can basically ensure those rare instances where a no-cause eviction is necessary. I understand that with mom-and-pop landlords where perhaps they're not as sophisticated, perhaps you know they just have one rental and that's their retirement income, and perhaps the exemption is appropriately applied to them. But I think that Margo is right. Where a property manager is making money on managing properties, then they shouldn't be using this tool, and we need to punish them if they do use this tool. Commissioner Fritz had a comment that if we were to adopt Ms. Black's language, that an owner would work with a property management company that would sell at the last minute. I note that Ms. Black's language actually includes the phrase, a landlord who at all times during the term of the rental agreement is a human being, blah, blah, blah. And I think that's a good option. I think that if we limit the cases to where there's a human being who manages the property, that person's self, throughout the tenancy and doesn't involve a property manager, then they should be exempt. But as soon as you start to involve shell companies and more sophisticated arrangements, then the person is more sophisticated, and they should be able to understand that if, in the rare instance, they need to no cause, they'll have to pay this fee. It's just part of the cost of doing business. It seems much more fair to put that on the side of people for whom this is passive income than the people for whom this is their home. Said differently, it seems that City Council is taking the position of people who own two houses and weighing that above the positions of people who have no houses. From the point of view of a tenant, it's impossible to know what the various ownership interests are. I'm an attorney. I can't claim to figure it out. I've had tenants come to me. I've had to turn them away because their property manager claims that – I'm sorry – because an owner claims, an LLC owner claims that they're the only, that's their only home in the city. I don't know whether that's true, but I can't afford, may I have just 30 more seconds, please? I don't know whether that's true, but I can't afford to, you know, sue and find out later. Those cases just won't be prosecuted. One tenant in particular I wanted to tell you about was somebody who was on a lease with a property management company in a home for quite some time. And then January, I believe, of this year, the property management company sold to a local developer. The developer stashed it in an LLC. About a month later, it issued a no-cause eviction. That LLC, as far as I can tell, only has one property that is a rental. It has other properties, but there are building permits on those, so I don't think that those are rentals. I can't take that case. That's a person who, you know, did everything right, was a victim of development, a victim of exactly what we're trying to protect, and that's a human being who I can't help, who can't have relocation. And I don't think that's the right policy.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Hi, my name is Anthony Benchivingo, and I'm an organizer with Portland Tenants United, and I do direct work with tenants on doorsteps when they contact PTU via Facebook messages, via emails, via phone. And I really want to second a lot of the comments that Alan Kessler just said about the fact that for a lot of tenants, it's very difficult to navigate the complex requirements around this law and whether or not they're eligible for relo, especially in cases where large landlords are trying to use this loophole where they can establish a bunch of different LLCs, which each only own one building, but would be under the same property manager or would be under potentially different names who are all directly related to them. Or just under different names of LLCs, even though they're all tied in various ways to the same person. The thing about relo is that it's working extremely well overall. I've talked to a lot of tenants who it's helped, but I've also talked to a lot of tenants who are not aware even of the details of this law and are certainly not aware, if their landlord doesn't tell them, that they're going to be eligible for it, even if they are. In the past 2 weeks, I've had two tenants contact me and say that they have landlords who they believe own multiple properties, but they aren't sure, and they aren't sure whether they're eligible for relo. And their property management company has either been non-responsive or, when they've asked, does my landlord own multiple properties, have refused to tell them, which they are perfectly in their rights to refuse to do. And I generally forward these tenants to look their landlords up on Portland Maps, but usually they're not able to find their landlord's name. It's difficult to navigate that. It's difficult to navigate the Secretary of State's website. One very recent tenant who I just talked to yesterday, actually, who wanted to be here today, but I don't think was able to make it, is under... in a building which is owned by Macaulay Enterprises, which is an LLC which owns 11 buildings across Portland, and all of them are under the same name, Macaulay Enterprises, but a slightly different number. So Macaulay Enterprises 5, Macaulay Enterprises 3, Macaulay Enterprises 2, etc. And when he contacted me, not realizing he was eligible for relo because they didn't tell him, I was able to, with the help of another PTU organizer, look this stuff up and figure it out and help him to find out that he was eligible. But this took like a solid hour with the help of another organizer, and it's because this is something that I've been doing for a while and I like know the tricks. Most tenants, especially ones who don't have experience doing public records requests, who don't have college educations, for whom English is a second language, for who are working people, this is extremely difficult, and this is a loophole which a lot of landlords who should be paying relo and are very much able to are using to get out of it. So I very much want to support amendments that would make it so that we limit the small landlord exemption to those whose personal names are on Portland Maps and to manage their single unit rentals personally, not through a property management company. Thank you.
Thank you.
So I'd just like to comment on that. Obviously, this is a thing that the ongoing committee will discuss more. Mm-hmm. And you had me right until the very last piece, which was I agree that it shouldn't count for LLCs. This is what the attorneys here came up with as to exclude that. So I think you'd agree that is a positive exception. Mm-hmm. Clarification. Mm-hmm. Probably there's another way to say it, but I don't think if an elderly couple, for example, is using the rental property for their retirement income and they are physically not capable of managing it themselves, presumably if you engage a property manager, you're paying part of the rent. You're not charging more rent because you've got a property manager, because that would the person who's wanting to buy the unit just wants to know what is the rent, and so I think the market forces would get there. So that's just something to think about as you continue on these discussions.
Thank you for your testimony. Colleagues, we have one amendment on the table from Commissioner Saltzman, and I view it as more of a clarification amendment as opposed to a tremendously substantive or technical amendment. I'd like to therefore ask if there is interest on the part of the council of changing this back to an emergency ordinance. I'd like to make that motion.
Second.
We have a second for discussion.
Yes. So, Mayor, If I may interrupt, the change that was discussed is a change to proposed code language, and that's not the type of amendment we can do on the fly. Luckily, in the example of the city that works very quickly, there's a city attorney right now printing out copies of proposed text for that amendment. So for your consideration, we'll be looking for that door to open shortly.
So let me potentially amend the amendment that Commissioner Saltzman has put on the table. It's my understanding, based on some quick and dirty research I did during testimony, that you, in fact, do not have the rulemaking authority for this particular portion of the code. So Commissioner Saltzman is correct that in order for it to be enacted, it does have to be a formal amendment. But rather than doing the amendment on the fly, could we give them the authority to carefully draft the language that supports the intention of your amendment?
Right. Well, I thought I understood from our attorney they're drafting that as we speak. Is that?
They are. So it's at council's option as to how you would prefer to handle it. If you have language that works to affect it, that's one option. Another would be to give the Bureau the authority to do
Well,
so.
Here's my question. We have 100 people in the room, some of whom are waiting for the next item, and this is the only thing left on the table. So unless that language is available right now, my preference would be to give you the authority to continue to work on that language and we move on. Otherwise, if it's ready, I'm certainly interested in hearing it.
Yeah.
The last email I have is that it's being printed and brought into chambers.
So. Okay. So it's on its way.
City Attorney's right. This is the city that works.
Commissioner Udaly? I'm sorry.
Do you want to respond to any of the testimony that was given in the meantime?
Kurt Krieger, Housing Bureau Director. This is a very delicate balance, and I'd say that it's not proportional, that owners of property have ceded in recognition that this is a life decision for a tenant, not just an economic decision. So they did so after lots of gut-wrenching debate and deliberation. And as you can see, once you start pulling at side issues, the whole agreement runs the risk of falling apart. I think it's to be commended that this group worked through some really tough issues during a legislative session when the legislature wasn't able to balance similar kinds of concerns. Hopefully it's a model for moving forward. And indeed, all of the policy issues were put into a parking lot. We were only dealing with technical corrections because both sides had things that they wanted to bring to the table, and Matthew needed to be a very tough enforcer about that traffic and narrowly construct the technical amendments. And that, I think, struck the right and correct balance. I don't disagree with Ms. Black's contention that when an individual property owner pierces the corporate veil by contracting with a property management company, that they have made a decision to put their business in the hands of another party, and they're willing to pay for that. That changes the business relationship. But that said, it wasn't really was not discussed.
Very good. And it's my understanding, Director Krieger, that with the amendments that are currently on the table, that is not under discussion. That we're putting in the parking lot for the committee to continue to discuss as part of a longer-term solution.
That's correct.
So we now have some language from the city attorney, and I guess to be precise, I'll move that language as a substitute to my verbally worded amendment. So the new language would read under subsection C, the foregoing terms and conditions regarding the tenant's rights and obligations regarding the relocation assistance shall be included with the landlord's payment of relocation assistance to the tenant.
And I continue to second that.
All right, so we have a substitute amendment on the table. Any further discussion on the substitute amendment? Please call the roll.
Saltzman.
Aye.
Udaly.
Aye.
Fritz.
I'll continue in kudos to Lisa Grump and the City Attorney's Office for getting this done so quickly. Aye.
Wheeler.
All right, the amendment is adopted. To the amendment of reestablishing the emergency clause, please call the roll.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Udaly?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Wheeler?
Aye. The amendment is adopted. Colleagues, any further questions or clarifications before we get to the main motion? Staff, anything else you'd like to add?
No, but thank you very much for taking up this issue.
Yeah. Great. Well, thank you. Very good. Please call the roll.
Salzman.
Well, I want to thank the committee. I want to thank the judge who upheld the constitutionality of this ordinance recently. Breitkopf, I believe his name is. Thank him for his wise decision. And I want to thank Matthew Schabold for carefully orchestrating the work of the committee to produce the products in front of us today. And so I'm pleased to support this, and I realize that we are really going to have to revisit this later. And the changes we're making are now, but I do feel the amendment we just passed is something that's a real here and now issue that people, as Commissioner Daly said, not a lot of people know about this relocation assistance ordinance, so it's important at this point more than ever that we make sure that landlords notify tenants of this program. And so please just support this package. Aye.
Daly.
Well, I also want to thank the Technical Advisory Committee for hanging in there with what I know were some really tough conversations, for considering the issues that we raised during the last hearing on this item and coming back with solutions that weren't what I had in mind, but I think are actually better. This is absolutely how this process should work. I want to thank the mayor and Commissioner Fritz for her clarifying amendments, as well as PHB staff, of course. Commissioner Saltzman beat me to the punch. I just wanted to hope, I hope that we would have a moment to revel in the ruling on our ordinance. We won the last legal challenge, we believe, and our relocation ordinance will stay in place, which is especially comforting considering we didn't get any tenant protections out of Salem this session. And I'm looking forward to the conversation moving forward. Aye.
Wheeler.
I'd like to add my...
Sorry.
We forgot somebody very important. Oh,
yeah. I'm the president. thank you. Well, we adopted the initial ordinance as an emergency in February, as was right and proper, because we are continuing to have a housing emergency. And I commend Commissioner Hugh Daly for her leadership in bringing it forward then and doing it as quickly as possible. Since then, there's been this wonderful new committee, which Mayor Wheeler directed and Commissioner Fish directed to have happen. And so there's been much more conversation about the pros and cons. And what I'm hearing now from all sides is more of an understanding of that there are pros and cons, and that sometimes you need to compromise. And that's kind of what the art of politics, and certainly on the City Council, that's what we try to do, so that everybody gets most of what they want, hopefully. Most of the time, not few people get exactly what they want on every single detail. So again, thank you to Commissioner Hugh Daly and Mayor Wheeler for partnering on this great effort, and Denis in the City Attorney's Office for arguing that case before the judge. Thanks to Golden Salazar in my office and Jamie Duell in Commissioner Hugh Daly's. This is really great staff work, as well as good work and good collaboration from everybody on the council. Aye.
Wheeler.
I'd like to thank Director Krieger and your team, Matt, in particular. I want to thank you. And I definitely want to add my name to the list of people thanking the Technical Advisory Committee for their incredibly hard work on this. And I know that there is much that the committee members do not agree on, and I appreciate the tone and the tenor of the conversations that have taken place in those committee meetings. I think we did a good job of putting the right people on that committee who could have some fairly direct conversations, and everybody still stayed around the table. And I think that's the best way to make policy. I agree with Commissioner Hugh Daly. It's disappointing to be here effectively 6 months after where we started, and realizing that we are going to have to continue to go on our own. We're going to have to continue to lead here from the City Council chamber in the absence of further statewide leadership. And we're perfectly content to do that. It means we've got a lot of work ahead of us. and I know we're up to the job. So I look forward to continuing to work with everybody on this important issue. I vote aye. The ordinance is adopted as amended. Thank you. So that brings us to items 798 through 800. I would ask that we please read all three of those items together.